Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with The Reason Podcast. We are talking about Bob Dylan, the maestro, winning the 2016 Nobel Prize in Literature for, quote, having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition, close quotes. Joining me are Reason Magazine senior editor Brian Dougherty, who's written early and often on Bob Dylan, as well as a senior editor at The Daily Beast, Andrew Carell, who has also, among other things, actually, Andrew, did you rate all of his songs or all of his albums?
Albums.
Yeah, which is almost as many, he's got as many albums as songs practically. But so Bob Dylan getting the Nobel Prize in Literature, this is a pretty exciting moment for people who are into Bob Dylan or into literature that is not necessarily simply the written word. You know, this is also a performed word. We're going to talk about the politics of Bob Dylan and whether or not he has any. We're going to talk about Dylan's essential inauthenticity, which is what really sets him, what we many of us think sets him apart from all other rock and popular music performers as well as public figures. And then Andrew, Brian, and I will also talk about our favorite albums by Dylan and why we think they're particularly worthy of note. Let's start talking about the politics of Bob Dylan. Brian, does Bob Dylan early in his career, he wrote protest songs. He kind of moved away from that. He made fun of the John Birch Society at various points in the early 60s. Does, you know, he later defended in song Hurricane Carter. Does Bob Dylan have a politics and does it matter?
He doesn't have a coherent ideology in the sense that people who write about politics for a living would recognize. He obviously has a strain of standing up for the underdog from Hurricane Carter, who is at least a perceived underdog in his version of the story, to, you know, the people fighting for civil rights in the early 60s, to people like Hattie Carroll, right, you know, beaten to death by a rich asshole, right? So he definitely...
And if I may, also a man by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Actually
tell the story of Dylan standing up for Lee Harvey.
He was
Oswald.
Being given a prize, and I might get the name of the, but like by the Tom Paine committee.
Yes, it was for like an ACLU like group. Yeah,
right. In December of 1963,
when being given the award. Right, this was at the height of him being sort of the leader of the civil rights folk rebellion. It wasn't an anti-war thing yet because the war wasn't a big deal. And Dylan, I think, would deny even being anti-war, despite being author of Masters of War. But at any rate, he decided to stand up to the underdog to such a degree that he spoke, and I don't have the words exactly, but he basically said something about how he could kind of get in the head of a Lee Harvey Oswald. Like, he knew where he was coming from. And I don't think he meant in the sense of, because I too wanted to kill JFK, but just in the sense that he could feel someone so alienated from his culture that he might commit such a horrific crime. Someone such an outsider that he actually, you know, killed the beloved king. And it made people very upset. And making people very upset has been one of my favorite aspects of Bob Dylan and all his various changes all the way along. So, I actually once tried to make the case. Oh, go on.
No, go ahead. Continue.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you wanted to put a label on Dylan, the modern Dylan, a paleoconservative is almost one that works. And I hooked this off largely in the liner notes to his 1993 folk song album, World Gone Wrong. He goes on a rant about how, you know, give me all the gang members that exist, and, you know, 100 acres of arable land, and I'll show you the true alternative lifestyle, agrarian.
Right.
A very interesting thing for a guy with Dylan's reputation to say.
Yeah, and it's always interesting because he's both the kind of bard of the open road from, well, you know, the Iron Hills of Minnesota, and yet he lives in Malibu and New York and other large cities almost exclusively, it seems. Andrew, what do you think about Bob Dylan's politics? Does he have one? And from a kind of libertarian perspective, is there, you know, is there a politics that appeals to libertarians?
Depends on how you read into his lyrics. I mean, there are times where you definitely can feel like he has some sort of you know, if you were to view it as a libertarian, you would be like, okay, yeah, this is, I mean, you just look at a lot of the civil rights songs. Those are pretty much in line with how libertarians view a lot of you know, personal issues, a lot of civil liberty stuff. But then, you know, he has this weird turn in the early 80s on Infidels, which I think confounded a lot of people. But, you know, the lyrics on a couple songs on Infidels, there was Union Sundown. Like, he almost made a turn for what I would call, I guess paleoconservative is actually pretty good, although paleocons would probably be a little bit opposed to how much he seems to love Israel with the song Neighborhood Bullies, which That's was right. not a very not so thinly veiled attempt to paint Israel as the neighborhood bully that was unfairly called as
well.
Much.
Andrew, you were raised Jewish, correct? On Lou Reed's Long Island.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So did you when you listen to Infidels, do you have to look past the slavish devotion to to that neighborhood bully?
He actually did. He went to Yom Kippur services mm-hmm. 1 year recently in Plainview near where I grew up, and everybody made a big deal out of that. And they're like, wasn't he just a Christian just recently? And then, you know, the thing we've all sort of hinted at before is that he constantly changes his identity. It'd be impossible to pin him down. And I feel like, you know, he originally in the 60s, I think it was the Talkin' John Birch Blues song, mm-hmm. you know, or whichever one it was, where he said, you know, I wouldn't let my daughter move into Barry Goldwater, move in next door to Barry Goldwater, or whatever it was.
But,
and then, you know, 40
yeah.
years later.
And then in Chronicle, though, he mentions,
in his memoir, yeah.
Yeah, in his memoir, Chronicle, he talks about how when Dave Van Ronk, the mayor of McDougal Street, the, old-time folky, who was a lefty, not so much in his music as in his everything else, but Dylan says something along the lines of, like, I wanted to tell Dave Van Ronk that I actually liked Barry Goldwater. He reminded me of Tom Mix, the cowboy actor, and I liked his county fair politics. So something odd. I mean, Dylan is always changing, right? You don't step into the same Dylan twice. Brian?
I like to mentioning Neighborhood Bully reminded me of something important about Dylan in politics, that whatever politics Dylan might have in his head or his heart, he doesn't want us to know about them, and he doesn't want us to think about them. In an interview when Infidels came out, I think it was actually Reason's own Kurt Loder might have been doing mm-hmm. this interview. He was pressing Bob on, like, hey, isn't Neighborhood Bully, that's really, you know, it sounds very bellicose and political. And Dylan's like, what's political about that song? It doesn't mention any political parties, does it?
Right.
Which is completely disingenuous, but shows that whatever he was thinking when he wrote that song, he didn't want to become a spokesman for that point of view. He didn't want to go, let me tell you why I think Israel is being unfairly treated. It's like, it's a song. Take it for, obviously it's about Israel, though mm-hmm. I guess if you wanted to not think that, you could not think it, because it doesn't say the word Israel. In the same way that when people Masters of War being anti-war, he denied that Masters of War was anti-war, which is crazy.
He, and of course on Infidels, which came out, what, in like 82, 83,
82,
something like that. And, you know, on the back is, I believe it's him and Jacob Dylan at the Wailing Wall, right? Getting, I think Jacob Dylan, who was bar mitzvahed. And that, of course, came after Dylan's Christian period, which goes to something else that I think you both have hinted at or suggested. You know, Dylan in the late 70s, the most sybaritic kind of hedonistic, the me decade, where people were just going everywhere and doing everything, he turns into a fire and brimstone preacher, and is not just doesn't just, you know, get like happy Jesus Christian. He goes full bore where he's talking about how his friends will be thrown into a lake of fire and they will beg God to kill them, but they won't be able to die. Brian, talk a little bit about that in the context of Dylan alienating whatever audience he happens to have at any given moment. And is that done in a kind of typical kind of rock star jerk thing where it's like, I don't want to play my old songs anymore, or is something more complex going on?
I think there's something more complex going on, but I like that as an explanation, because he did, for the 3 or 4 years after his Christian turn, stop playing all of his old hits and do nothing but an all gospel show. And then by late 81, I think he began putting the oldies back in. People were so dedicated to Dylan that when Slow Train Coming came out, Jan Wenner, dragged himself out of the iceberg to actually write the review in Rolling Stone. And I'm guessing it's because he couldn't find anyone else to write a good review of it. But he wrote, and he was right about this, that this is, you know, a masterpiece, and it might even be Dylan's finest work, which it might be. But it was wonderful that, at least at the start, a lot of his old fans were so into their vision of Bob, that they had to keep believing in him, even when he was in no uncertain terms telling them to jump into a lake of fire and burn.
Yeah.
You know, that's what a stronghold Dylan had on his fans.
He was sick of his friends telling him about Buddha and telling him about Muhammad in one breath.
One long breath. He would have to be an extremely truculent, you know, dick to do things like that just to give the middle finger to people.
Right. But shows up and he's Mr. Folky. Then he starts writing his own material. Hey, you're not supposed to do that. Then he goes electric. Then he disappears. Then he goes country, you know, in the middle of, the psychedelic period. He's hanging out with Johnny Cash and talking about big brass beds. Andrew, what do you see at work here? Is Dylan, is he just another jerk rock star, or why is he doing this?
You know, I always try to see, are his impulses the same as another person that I would view has done the same thing a lot, but has not been as successful as changing their identity, as Neil Young, mm-hmm. where, you know, in the early 80s, Neil Young did the same thing where he tried to shrug his previous identity and started writing, you know, well, he was also trying to get out of a label deal, but, you know, it's just a completely different thing. For me, the instinct behind Dylan is it seems like his entire career has been to almost like it's almost like a conquest of a different group of people, where he becomes sort of, he writes the perfect song that speaks to that group. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as they discover that song, he says, okay, screw you guys, I'm done with that movement. So, you know, the Civil Rights, right? I mean, you know, My Back Pages was officially his, you know, his resignation from the folky left, the right. Pete Seeger-ish movement. And then, you know, he renounced the psycho, you know, the psychic, you know, the hippie, you know,
right.
that generation with, you know, Nashville Skyline. And actually, maybe John Wesley Harding was more of a, mm-hmm. was more of a move away from that. But, you know, or Self-Portrait was a renunciation of, you know, sort of, he was basically giving the finger to music critics who had put him on this pedestal for so long, and constantly, you know, the Christian period. And then in the 80s, when he had that sort of confounding flirtation with 80s production on Empire Burlesque. Right. And then, you know, the three albums where he sort of lost his muse. And I don't really know what he was trying to do with Knocked Out Loaded and Under the Red Sky. It's not really quite clear if he was trying to piss anybody off or he just entirely lost his ability to make a coherent album again.
Well, but, you know, before we move on to the next stage, too, I guess one question is, is he a calculating person? Is he coming up with the next phase, or did he really believe, you know, in Jesus as his personal Lord and Savior during the Christian period? Did he really believe in the anti-war movement? Did he, you know, believe in Hurricane Carter and then move on? Or, I mean, because one of the things that is impressive to me about him is that whatever he is singing at the moment, I mean, he really seems to believe it. It's not, I think people like David Bowie to a certain degree, I think Bruce Springsteen, I think Johnny Cash, I mean, a lot of iconic performers seem to be kind of faking it. For me, Mick Jagger is the ultimate rock star who is insecure. Mick Jagger is like the Donald Trump of rock stars. He is, you know, he should be able to relax and say, I'm one of the, you know, the five great rock gods. But he's always trying to be somebody else. He's uncomfortable with himself, whereas Dylan seems supremely comfortable with whatever he's doing.
Yeah.
I agree with that. And I think that's, you know, that's part of his attraction. And it's what makes the inauthentic, what I called his inauthenticity, work, mm-hmm. is because, you know, he does manage to convince you every step of the way that this is me. I used to be that guy. Now I'm this guy now. And I'm sure most people listening to this don't actually follow his career very closely, mm-hmm. except the three of us. So I'll spell out that the Dylan for the last 4 years has basically reinvented himself as a crooner in the Great American Songbook tradition.
Right. Yep.
His last two LPs are all covers associated with Sinatra. And his last show prior to being hired by the Coachella people to do their big oldie show has been about a third of these Sinatra songs. So that's the latest Dylan.
Talk a little, you know, one of the things, and this is also, you know, the other thing that is unbelievable about Dylan is just the sheer longevity of his career. I mean, you know, we're talking about from the early 60s through the current moment. And the jokes about Dylan having a shitty voice, you know, no longer, you know, they just don't, it doesn't matter. It's a stupid, I mean, and he and the rock era helped kind of banish the idea that there was one aesthetic that governed, you know, kind of tunefulness of voice and all of that. He's more than any single person, he probably is the person who created the idea of the, you know, that a real pop music god writes his own material, etc. Brian, what is he doing by going back to songs of his youth sung by Sinatra in particular? So it's like you go from, you know, the perfect pipes of America's greatest saloon singer in Sinatra to these croaky, you know, kind of stretched out vocal cords of Bob Dylan. What is happening with, you know, is it, what's the aesthetic impulse there?
I should admit, and hopefully this makes what I'm about to say sound more authoritative, is that Dylan has finally pushed me too far. I do not like these albums. I don't hate them, but I don't enjoy listening to them. And seeing him do it live works a little bit better. But at any rate, if you ask him, he sort of says that, well, these songs, you know, have a timeless grace and speak to the human condition and the human heart in a really amazing way, which is true. But given that he is well aware that people have been making fun of the way he sings, you know, for 50 years, mm-hmm. you do have to assume that there's a little bit of the old middle finger again, him saying like, look, there's this tradition of songs that you guys have always said belongs to people with a great controlled, trained voice. Right. And I'm going to tell you that these songs are just as great or maybe even greater with my like completely insane non-professional croak. And I go see Dylan live every chance I get. And I have to say it is on a certain level laughable the way he sings nowadays. I mean, it really is like, and if you're surrounded by poor folk who just like, oh, I'm going to go see that guy with the acoustic guitar and the harmonica around his neck, sing Tambourine Man. And they don't know what's happening, you know, Mr. Jones, and they buy an $80 ticket to see Dylan. There is nothing more fun than walking out of a recent Dylan performance and listening to people bitch. Like, and they're almost right to do so if they think they bought a ticket to see a professional singer professionally sing. But as I say, he's become the Picasso of the human voice. He's made the human voice non-representational. It's just this weird, bizarre, like, croak is a cliche, but that's kind of what it is. And it's something we've never heard before and might never hear again, you know. So
Andrew, talk a little bit about, you're a huge Dylan nut, but you're also a Springsteen fanboy. Talk a bit, you know, and this to me it's kind of an interesting, you know, relationship artistically, aesthetically, chronologically, all sorts of ways, because, you know, if one of the knocks on Dylan, or one of the things is that he took on a Woody Guthrie persona that was non-representative of Woody Guthrie in many ways. And then, you know, Springsteen was billed as the next Bob Dylan, you know, and he's the only next Bob Dylan who actually seems to have, you know, actually had a career about it. But what is the relationship between Bob Dylan and Bob and Bruce Springsteen for you? And is there a continuity there, or is there a disjuncture that's worth exploring?
Well, while we're talking about authenticity, I think, you know, one of the things that often comes up about Springsteen is he too, like Bob, probably I would argue less successfully so, has managed to meld himself into something that he really isn't. I mean, you know, Bruce Springsteen is from New Jersey, Long Branch, New Jersey, from Freehold. He's not, he put on this, you know, sort of fake oaky accent, and he talks about, you know, the farm. A lot of his songs in the mid 80s were written from the perspective of the poor farmer. And he's
and
obsessed
this
with,
is,
you know,
yeah, this is if Bob Seger, in every Bob Seger song, it is, you know, there is a sound of thunder. In every Bruce Springsteen song after about Born in the USA, it's some oaky walking along a highway with holding a hat in his hand, calling somebody mister.
The highway is on the edge of town, you know, and there's a lot of darkness happening, and you know, I'll meet you at a party out on the edge of town, I think is a line that Springsteen mentions at least 10 times in his career. But I think he's sort of done the same thing, and he was inspired to take on that persona, actually, because I think the story goes that John Landau gave him a copy of Woody Guthrie's memoir, which was also very inspiring to Bob Dylan. It's So that's, I think, the parallels between the two of them. I would argue that Dylan has more successfully taken on various personas just because he's more believable in his inauthenticity, whereas Springsteen, it's like, if you know anybody from New Jersey, you just don't believe that you know, that's the person he is now.
And, of course, there was that great story from a few years ago where Bob Dylan was arrested in Long Branch, New Jersey, which is right, near Asbury Park. Dylan has taken, supposedly, to looking up houses where famous songs were written. And he was looking at the house, I think, that Born to Run was written at, and he was arrested by cops. And, of course, because he's Bob Dylan, he doesn't carry any money or identification. And the cops had no idea of who he was, which is kind of wonderful. Brian, would you, you know, what do you think of the relationship between somebody like Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen? Are they... You know, are they similar, or in the end, is there a big difference between them?
Yeah, I was just today reading someone, and I'm totally ripping this off from something I read, and maybe if you guys read it, you can tell me who it was. Maybe it was Andrew, for goodness sake. Basically saying that Springsteen has a sort of, team, we're all in this together, triumphal feel about him. Where he's reaching out to you and he wants you to love him and he wants to create this atmosphere of communal joy. Whereas Dylan on stage is just like, I'm this weird guy in a hoodie in my own bizarre world doing my thing. And you're staring at me for some reason. I don't know why, but, you know, here I am.
I think you were referring to Penn Gillette's gloss on Dylan.
Yes.
One of the things
we recently
interviewed.
At Reason.com.
Yeah, of all places.
And Penn was 100% correct.
Yeah.
And he stated it beautifully. And I never thought of it that way, but that's exactly right. And that's part of why, you know, misanthropic folk like myself tend to embrace Dylan a little bit more closely, because it doesn't feel like he's inviting us in. And that feels good.
And yet, as Penn, and I think he's right about this, where he says, but what's interesting is that Dylan is constantly moving forward. He's exploring what he finds interesting in the world. And he actually, that's how he ends Chronicles, where he talks about leaving, casting himself out from the Garden of Eden that was the Greenwich Village folk scene in the early 60s, because he knew that he wouldn't flourish there, or that he would kind of end up dying there without achieving anything. And he goes out on the open road, where he says, you know, it's uncertain, but it's more adventurous. And I think that there's something to that with Dylan, that he invites us to witness his journey, but he doesn't, you know, demand that we love him or even really engage him or fully understand him.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about our favorite albums then for Dylan, and then let's try and tie it back in. You know, this is the Reason podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes, on RSS feeds, on SoundCloud. Go to reason.com/podcast to get all that information. But we'll try and tie it back into a kind of libertarian politics I've got in the broadest sense possible. But Andrew, what's your favorite Dylan record and why?
To Put It on the Tracks is probably my favorite. I put it as number one on the definitive ranking that I wrote, trying, you know, both from my perspective and also as taking an objective stance of like what his masterpiece is. It would be either Blonde on Blonde or Blood on the Tracks, which are two very cliched choices. But Blood on the Tracks for me, I think, is...
Why is... for you then? You know, and talk personally, because this is also one of the things that is brilliant about Dylan is, and that album among others, but maybe more than others, is totally personal and confessional, and yet it's universal in its themes and appeal, it seems.
Right. And one of the interesting things about that is that years after the album came out, I think it was recently, or maybe it was in the interview a couple of years ago with Rolling Stone, he said he never really quite understood why people love the album so much, because it's so deeply personal. Like, how can you fall in love with a record that is just filled with so much pain? Because it was basically about his divorce from Sarah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really, you know, we were talking about how Dylan often goes out of his way to push everybody away from him. But I think on this record, he invites you to see him as a human in a lot of ways. And I think that's probably what I love about it so much, is that the lyrics, you know, everybody's experienced a shitty relationship. Everybody's gone through a breakup. Everybody's experienced heartbreak. Everybody's experienced, you know, nostalgia that he expresses on a lot of the songs. And I think he puts it in a really concise, beautifully orchestrated a bunch of songs, and there's not even a single, it's an incredible rock album, and there's no electric guitar on it.
It's also, I think we have all also conspired to pull off an incredibly complicated bank heist that worked out pretty well for us as well. In the one, I mean, do we all agree that Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts is one of the worst songs of all time?
It's a waste. It's a waste of space. But
I love that song.
Right. How? What do you love about it?
It tells a fascinating story. Like that's the song that justifies him having just won the Nobel. Yeah. It's like a novel in song with.
I would say Idiot Wind, but yeah.
Why?
Well, and, this is Idiot Wind is certainly Dylan. One of his underappreciated arts is of the put down song.
The vitriol.
And that is brilliant because he recoups himself into the hatred in the closing line, but. I don't know, Brian. You know, if there are songs with worse rhymes in them than Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, I don't know that I want to hear it.
Mozambique or...
Do either of you, and Brian, I know your answer to this, so I know... I mean, what do you guys think of Desire? I think that is a kind of mentally retarded Dylan record where...
I put it in my top 10.
Literally every song on it is... You know, is either lionizing somebody like Hurricane Carter, who was almost certainly guilty of the crimes that he was accused of, or Joey Gallo, who is a truly horrible human being, or it's kind of like Nacho Libre style tales of cantinas and corn chips in the tropical islands.
Man. I want to actually say, bring it back to the Nobel. I want to say that I myself, because I. Like I think Nick and obviously Andrew, I think about Bob Dylan like way too much, right? Obviously. And it was a couple of years ago, I think I was listening to Modern Times or something or one of the records I don't love and thinking like, why do I love this guy so much? Like, and I was having a hard time justifying why I find his music so moving. So I'm glad that the Nobel Committee has sort of, I'm able to outsource my own judgment to them and go like, well, who is more qualified to judge literary merit than the Nobel Literature Committee? So I'm glad that I no longer have to come up with a coherent explanation for why, you know, Joey is an amazing work of art, which I do believe, because I can just go, hey, it's by Dylan. And he's
like
a master.
It because, you know, it's rhetorical question. You know, what did he do to, you know, make the mob want to shoot him down? And it's like, well, he double crossed them and then triple crossed them. He stole from them. I mean, he broke every rule in the mafia rulebook. Brian, what is your favorite album and why?
Blonde on Blonde, another you know, cliche choice, but a true one. I got into it when I was like 12 years old, right? And I didn't really understand what like the whole man woman romance thing was like, but I found it an incredible like pre-introduction to what human interpersonal relationships felt like, and it was misty and weird and sad and funny and exhilarating and it had the blues in it, which I didn't then and still don't actually care about the blues, and yet I still love Bob Dylan, and he can just rollick through the blues and I'm gonna love it. And most importantly, it had that organ sound that is sort of kind of an apotheosis in many people's mind of what Dylan music sounds like, even though he barely used it before and barely used it since. But he used it so brilliantly and so evocatively that the notion of like a wheezing organ and a wheezing voice like is forever going to say Bob Dylan to people. And so it's got, and it has to be about the sound as well as the words. And because, of course, Dylan is a musician. And the way that record sounds is just very deep and compelling and wonderful to me.
Andrew, you're also a fan of Blonde on Blonde. What do you like about that?
I mean, that's the original double album, I guess, in a lot of ways, or I mean, it should be longer. But it's funny you mentioned the organ thing, because that organ sound on those two records, Highway 61 and then Blonde on Blonde, I think was an accident originally. Yeah. Wasn't it like Al Kooper in the studio they originally did a take of Like a Rolling Stone without that organ, and then Al Kooper was just fooling around.
According to Al Kooper, the organ player who also, he wrote hits for people like Gary Lewis and the Playboys. I think he wrote This Diamond Ring. And then went on to found Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He discovered as a producer, he discovered or basically created Lynyrd Skynyrd sound, or helped them come to that. Very interesting character in music, and wrote a biography where he said that he lied his way into the studio for that and had never really played that type of organ before and whatnot. And who is the producer on Like a Rolling Stone? It was Tom Dowd or Tom Wilson?
No, it was a Bob Johnson, I think, had taken
not
over.
A, right, yeah, yeah, I don't actually think on like a Rolling Stone, but it's, yeah, in any case, there was something.
Oh, no, not Rolling Stone. Yeah, that yeah. was Tom Wilson. Yes.
Right, yeah. And Johnson did the Nashville records, too, I believe, with Dylan. And,
right, by Blonde
with,
on Blonde, yeah. yeah.
But so part of it is just the scale or the breadth of the album, right? On yes. Blonde and Blonde, there's so much of it. And it's, yeah, when you start to think about, you know, and this, it's weird now to think in a world that is post-album in at least two ways. One, you know, record albums come on CDs if they, or they stream, and you don't think about them that way, but the whole kind of drama of opening up a gatefold record and knowing there's like, you know, an hour and a half of music on this, as opposed to the typical in the mid 60s, you know, bands like the Byrds, who I love and are highly indebted to the, to Dylan, you know, they were putting out albums that clocked in at like 24 minutes, for the entire yeah. album. Just, there was so much of it and it had a depth and a texture. What I picked, partly after like knowing what you guys were doing, I'm going with Time Out of Mind, his late 90s record, which brought him kind of acclaim. I think he won a couple of Grammys for it. And it's really what I like about that album is that it's a very old voice, a wise voice, a croaky voice, but it's perfectly measured. And it's really about, it seems to be about mortality. He's talking about trying to get to heaven before they shut the door. There's both humor and deeply, deeply mournful music on that record. What do you guys think of Time Out of Mind?
I put it in my top five on that article I wrote, and I got a lot of shit for it from people who probably are the same people who buy tickets to see him now and then are pissed off that he doesn't play the Times as They're Changing. But I would, I think that's a modern masterpiece. I think it's one of the best albums of the 90s.
I love it too. And Nick, my reason for loving it again is,
I'm sorry, Brian, you dropped out. Could you repeat that?
Oh yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, my reason for loving it is largely the way it sounds. It has a very unique, that misty, swampy, Lanois sound, and Dylan's modern croak fits in very, very well with it. It has a great atmosphere of doom that of course is a lot of fun to revisit over and over again.
So in the 21st century, and in Penn Jillette, who you know has called Dylan his hero, and I think I see why, and it's that relentless sense of it. You know, for a long time, I always thought Dylan was great because he was constantly reinventing and recreating himself. I think that's kind of wrong in the sense that Dylan continues to explore and seek out new things and new experiences in a way that very few rock stars do. I mean, you know, Vince Neil has not progressed very much as a you know, as a human being, or Sammy Hagar since they became rock stars. Neil Young, Andrew, who you mentioned earlier, is an example of somebody who had absolutely one of the most tremendous 70s and early 80s of music and then kind of lost it. And I would argue he stopped growing as a person in many ways. He would obviously disagree with that. But Dylan keeps seeking out new things and reporting back from wherever he ends up, which is fascinating. But is there a way to talk about, you know, Dylan, he's not a libertarian, even if he's at various points has both mocked Barry Goldwater and said kind words about Barry Goldwater. But is there a larger message in his life or in his career that is somehow has an affinity with a libertarian sensibility? Brian, what do you think?
Yeah. The notion that he is going to do what he wants. He's sort of a living example of the kind of cornucopic libertarian vision of modern culture, that he's not going to be held back by the rules of his business, the rules of his community, you know, the rules of his political comrades. He's just going to he's a living bard of freedom. And as I think I hinted earlier, I think the through line is that he's for the underdog. And being for the underdog can often make you sound very libertarian. It can often make you sound a little bit statist, but I do love, as I've written at Reason, that when you try to make him say nice things about the president, even a president that he clearly probably does like Obama, he's not going to do it. He is not going to become a spokesman for any specific politician or political cause, and that's very admirable.
Andrew, what do you, when you have children and you bore them to death by putting on Bob Dylan streams or whatever we will be plucking out of the ether in the future, when you turn them into a generation of Dylan haters, what will you be trying to force into their minds that they refuse to admit?
I mean, I was going to say, but the question you asked Brian is, what's the message, the libertarian message, if at all? And that's the message, the lack thereof, actually, I think is why I admire him so much politically, because, you know, I myself struggle with labels. I don't know if I would call myself 100% a libertarian all the time. And, you know, I think that's what's so empowering about Dylan is you can constantly find yourself in new places and reinvent yourself and not want to, you know, I think it's a constant struggle against being pigeonholed. And I think that's, you know, it's corny to say, but I think that's like a good lesson for kids to learn is like, don't let other people define you and don't define yourself in certain terms. Just keep learning and keep finding new experiences and always let your views and your beliefs kind of shape shift with how you feel or what you see in the world around you as you learn new experiences. I didn't think of it until then, but that's an interesting way to look at it.
He's like an ultra individualist and not in a, you know, not like in a Rush song.
Ayn Rand.
He's not like the maple, or what, I guess it's the oak tree, right? That's getting screwed over by the maple tree and in the trees.
Yeah, exactly. He is just the, it's individualism, not in a political or in a sort of like anti-altruistic way. It's an individualism in a way of like, well, just, you know, learn about yourself, be about yourself and enjoy the self and figure out yourself and don't let other people tell you who you are, essentially.
Last question for each of you, quick answers. Do you think he has another great album that galvanizes public response, either positive or negative? But you know, where Time Out of Mind was one of those where people took notice of it, the music industry and a broader industry. Obviously, it's an even more fractured popular culture now. Does he have another great album in it? And what's your guess at what it might be if he does? Brian, you first.
Yeah, I think it's possible because the upside of his current live show, which is very Sinatra based, is that this is a guy, he's 73 or whatever. No one wants him to rethink what he's doing. No one expects him to, but he's doing it anyway. Like, I don't particularly love what he's doing with it, but he's got an artistic mind that's still trying to figure out a new way to get across the feeling he's trying to get across. So if he is still capable of writing at all, and if he manages to live another 2 years, I do think that there's going to be another great album of Dylan originals that's probably going to go in a different direction than his last few. And I'm excited to hear it. Whether the world is going to care, it's hard to know. But now that he's a Nobel laureate, they'll probably be paying even closer attention.
What about you, Andrew? What do you think?
Yeah, I think as he inches closer to mortality, I think he's got it in him, especially if like a lot of his sort of cohorts die off in the meantime. I think that'll inspire him maybe to do another Time Out of Mind. Also, Love and Theft was a great record, too.
Yeah. Right.
Although, you know, a lot of those words weren't really his own, the whole accusation, the plagiarism and everything. But I think he's definitely got it in him. It'll just have to be something different than the most recent one, which the only thing that was really remarkable about it that the media made a big deal of was that 11-minute song about the Titanic, which, you know, that's a very Dylan thing to do. But, you know, I'm not sure that would be a timeless record if he were to replicate that.
I hope that he either releases another album and maybe, you know, my secret belief, because and I think we might all feel this way about Dylan, is that you can, I mean, there is real stuff there, but then you can also project. He's enigmatic enough and gnomic enough that you project onto him various things. And I'm hoping that he fully explores his beatnik kind of connections. Because to me, it seems to me that he's much more Kerouac than he is Pete Seeger or Woody Guthrie. And I would love to hear an urban album that somehow recaptures the moment, you know, right as he shows up in New York and is finally for the first time in a big city or in the big city. But time will tell, and maybe it's not too late for him to go to law school or medical school. Maybe he'll win a Nobel Prize for medicine next. We can hope. We will leave it there. I want to thank Andrew Carell of The Daily Beast and Brian Doherty of Reason Magazine for talking about Bob Dylan, Nobel laureate. Oh, you know what? It's mind-numbing, and I don't know if it might – the best thing of this is it may drain out completely the – you know, the meaning of a Nobel Prize. So it's another win for Bob Dylan. We will leave it there. You're listening to The Reason Podcast. Check us out. Subscribe to us. Rate and review us at iTunes, at SoundCloud. Go to Reason.com podcast, and you can pick up RSS feeds, not just for the podcast, but also for videos that we're putting out basically every day. Thanks for listening.